It is not easy reading old newspapers. A lot of the language is difficult, articles are often unnecessarily verbose. Worse still, a lot of the concepts, rules, laws, procedures and assumptions, while entirely familiar to contemporary readers, are entirely alien to us. There are assumptions about the world that we simply don't make. So I thought it might be useful to explain as best I can how the world at the outset of 1924 would appear to a reader of the times. Hopefully, that will make the weekly episodes easier to understand. Very little can be understood without understanding the First World War. The First World War changed the world for good. The post-war period may now be longer than the war itself, but that does not mean that the world has returned to, or even arrived at, a time that could remotely be described as normal. In Britain, some 1.25 million people are unemployed. Before the war, although the Times would occasionally talk of idleness, it was a minor problem. To what extent unemployment is due to depressed economic conditions, and to what extent the presence of the dole, which was a new thing in those days, is unclear to me. Nevertheless, there is a clamouring for the government to do something. This something is either for more relief, which runs into an incentive problem, or to create make-work schemes. Getting the unemployed to build roads and railways may sound like a good idea. It will be taken up with enthusiasm by the Nazis. But there are all sorts of problems with it. What roads? What railways? What quality? Do the unemployed have the right skills? Are the schemes worth it? What jobs might have been created if the resources had been used elsewhere? Much of Britain's economic problem lies with the pound. Before the war, the pound was worth about a fifth of an ounce of gold. You could even take a £5 note to the Bank of England and get gold in exchange. During the war, the government printed money to pay the massive costs of the war. Prices have increased by something like 75%. But the value of the pound has hardly changed at all. For reasons that I don't entirely understand, and could include such airy-fairy things such as sentiment, and don't include interest rates, which seem perfectly normal, it is massively overvalued. Inflation has continued to rip since. The Crozier ratio, based on converting to and from gold, and then applying the Crozier fudge factor of a half, is 150. In other words, take a 1923 sum in pounds, multiply it by 150, and you'll get a representative price in today's pounds. During the Napoleonic War, the pound also went off the gold standard. But afterwards, it was once again made convertible into gold. Many in 1923 think that this should happen again. Indeed, a committee was set up in 1918 to examine this very question, and concluded that the pound should indeed go back onto the gold standard. However, there is a big difference. In the 1820s, the Bank of England had competition. It was not the only issuer of banknotes. And those other issuers kept the Bank of England honest. Since then, legislation has eliminated that competition. Politicians effectively control the money supply, and are unwilling to relinquish that control. The government is currently running a surplus. Taxation is high, although not nearly as high as today, and there are frequent complaints about its level. Related to all economic affairs is the issue of reparations. Wars are expensive. So is reconstruction. During the war, the British lent to the French and Italians, and the Americans lent to the British. The Treaty of Versailles stipulated that on the basis that you broke it, you fix it, Germany was to pay. But Germany doesn't want to pay, and no one can make it. The lesson of this particular mess, which may have some bearing on more contemporary matters, is that allies should wipe out each other's debts at the end of a war. There is something of a housing crisis going on. Rents are controlled. As any economic fool know, if you artificially depress a price, then you get queues or lack of availability. This would appear to be the case in 1923. Rent control was initially introduced as an emergency wartime measure, a bit like pub closing time, but has persisted into peacetime. You would have thought that a Conservative government would have been all in favour of getting rid of the controls, but apparently not. In 1918, Britain adopted the universal adult male franchise, and the vote for women over the age of 30 with a property qualification. 5 years on, the Labour Party has supplanted the Liberal Party as the second largest party in the House of Commons. The Liberal Party, which split into supporters of Lloyd George and supporters of Asquith during the First World War, have managed to cobble together their differences in order to fight for free trade. A bigger problem is that over the last 30 years or so, very few of their number have managed to remain particularly liberal, in the sense of believing in low taxes and low regulation. Instead, both factions have embraced a big government in the form of state pensions and unemployment benefit, while allowing the growth of trade unions. Others have seen the writing on the wall and jumped ship to Labour. This is a world which still has university seats and two member seats. It is also a world in which senior politicians can command audiences numbered in the thousands. It may surprise some to learn that welfare did exist before 1945. Welfare is a bit of a hodgepodge. There is unemployment benefit, known as the dole, administered by a government department. There is also outdoor relief administered by locally elected poor law boards. These boards also organise indoor relief, otherwise known as workhouses. The state also provides an old age pension and a GP service. This is very similar to the service that voluntary, membership-funded friendly societies provided before 1910. In real life, no one is particularly happy with the way the war on drugs is going. If nothing else, everyone agrees there are an awful lot of drugs about. In the 1920s, the war on drugs was a new thing. So new, in fact, that they hadn't got round to banning cannabis. Of course, it is difficult to say, but it would appear that availability in those days was much less, which might be because they were prepared to punish consumers as well as sellers. But it is a stretch to argue that prohibition has made the world a better place. In Britain, the number of motorised vehicles on the road is approaching 1 million. This despite the fact that the annual tax on cars, or road fund licence, is very high. Roads are incredibly dangerous. There is a lot of drunk driving, but roads are dangerous enough even without that. There is no compulsory driving test, a lot of doubt even over what the rules of the road should be, and no zebra or pelican crossings. On the railways, the forced mergers of tens of separate railways into the Big Four has for the most part gone smoothly. However, state control of freight rates, passenger fares, and even the amount of profit companies can make will exact their toll before long. For the most part, this is still the age of steam, although all the London Underground is electrified, as are some suburban lines. Mainline electrification is being looked at. The British Broadcasting Company is celebrating its first birthday. Broadcasting on a regional basis, most of its output is music, although Women's Hour is already a thing. For the most part, it has steered clear of politics, concerned that doing so might bring its impartiality into doubt. The BBC has an unusual funding model. It has a licence fee, much as it does today. It also has founder companies, who are the only companies permitted to sell wireless receivers. They pay a proportion of their revenue to the BBC. Things were bad enough in Germany before the dawn of 1923. Riven by coups from both communists and nationalists, attempted coups, assassinations, private armies and inflation, the government claimed that it was unable to pay the reparations that it had agreed to in the Versailles Treaty. This prompted the French to invade and occupy the Ruhr Valley, the centre of German industry. This in turn prompted the German government to support the resistance. As they had no money coming in to do this, they printed it, leading to, if not the worst hyperinflation ever, certainly the best known. This in turn led to food shortages and riots. Amidst this, the government introduced martial law, which was followed shortly afterwards by the attempted Hitler-Ludendorff putsch. Yes, Ludendorff was up to his neck in it. Somehow that was put down, but French boots still pace Essen streets. And if all that wasn't enough, the French are sponsoring a Rhineland separatist movement. Still, could be worse. All the news coming out of the Soviet Union, the world's first communist state, is bad. Starvation, poverty, extrajudicial murder, persecution of the church, rigged elections, corruption, child abuse. You name it, they've got it. And this is all under Lenin. This spectre is terrifying people in Europe. A large part of the success of the Italian fascists is down to this. Elsewhere in Europe, the Irish Civil War has come to an end, mainly after the Free State government started executing the rebels. There is surprisingly little news out of Italy, despite this being Mussolini's first year in office, other than the occasional act of brutality carried out by the fascists. In Poland, they've assassinated a president, and in Bulgaria, a prime minister. There has been a coup in Spain. If much of the world was plunged into turmoil during and after the First World War, the United States was not. It makes something like 85% of the world's cars. It has made some attempt to redress the balance by introducing alcohol prohibition, but for most Americans, that is merely an inconvenience. Otherwise, America continues to prosper. One lone British voice has suggested that lending is too high and this could lead to trouble, but he has been ignored. In August, the great Warren Harding died, to be succeeded as president by the equally great and almost silent Calvin Coolidge. The pyramid scheme and part-time terrorist organization known as the Ku Klux Klan continues to prosper. China is weaker than it has been for centuries. The monarchy was overthrown before the First World War, but the victors started squabbling amongst themselves, with the consequence that the bandit-infested country is dominated by regional warlords. It is very difficult to sum up something as vast as the British Empire in a few sentences. Certainly the Times regards it as a good thing. Still, the forces that will break it up are there to be seen. The British settled colonies like Canada and Australia are becoming increasingly independent. Indian nationalism is on the rise despite, or perhaps because of, the introduction of local democratic assemblies. In an attempt to bring the empire together and to deal with domestic unemployment, the conservative/unionist government has fought a general election on a platform of tariffs on non-British Empire goods, or imperial preference, as it was known. And it's been soundly beaten. The League of Nations exists, and that's about all you can say about it. It doesn't do an awful lot, although there are those who claim that all would be well if it did. Looking perhaps a bit more widely, this is a world which still has the death penalty, still has corporal punishment for that matter. Divorce is difficult, but not impossible. As an aside, most of the cases that reach the pages of the Times concern the restitution of conjugal rights or the compulsion of one party to the marriage to live with the other. I think this is a formality and a stepping stone to a full divorce, but I'm not quite sure. Suicide or attempted suicide is illegal. Those who are successful are invariably found as being of unsound mind at the time of their deaths. Justice is dispensed extremely quickly. Cases, even murder cases, come to court within weeks, are dealt with in days, and verdicts are arrived at within minutes. This last one is perhaps at least partially down to jurors not being paid for their time. Crime is very low. Even burglaries get reported in the Times. Murder is incredibly low, and most people are entitled to own firearms. How hard are people's lives? The Times doesn't give too many clues. Frequently you will see ads for products like Bovril, Wincarnis and Crucian salts that are supposed to give people energy, the implication that there are a lot of people out there who are feeling pretty run down. Also, a lot of space is given over to various schemes for reducing unemployment, which suggests that it was pretty awful to be unemployed. But that's about it. The Times exists in a world of relatives. The poor of the time relative to the rich of the time. The poor of the time relative to the poor of before the war. And what might seem rich to the Times would to a large extent seem poor to us. Sure, you might have a big house and lots of staff, but there's no penicillin, polio vaccine, many diseases, pollution, no internet, no mobile phones, no telly. Air travel is slow and dangerous. Cars are dangerous, uncomfortable, unreliable, and slow. One of the great surprises of reading The Times is just how important agriculture, religion, and monarchy are. I had thought that the Industrial Revolution and its embrace of science and reason would have put these in the shade. But no, there are frequent articles dedicated to farming issues. Senior clergy get their sermons published on holy days, and the doings of the king and queen are frequently mentioned. Some even try to preserve the fiction that the king is the true ruler of the country. Primary education is compulsory, and in most cases provided by the state. Higher education is entirely privately funded, although I believe there are funds available for promising students. What happens at the secondary school level is a bit of a mystery, but there are plenty of teachers complaining that they don't get paid enough. Anyway, I hope that's useful. If not, please let me know, and I'll be back soon.